all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, world, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I am honored to be your host today here on Veterans Radio. I am a former CW-2 type helicopter pilot during Vietnam, and it's very exciting today. We got a great program. We're going to be talking with a representative from the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, and to find out what's going on with the legislature today and see what the Congress is going to try and do to mess around with veterans' benefits next. You know, they always got to figure out a way to save money, and it seems like they always go to the least people that, you know, that need the help the most is where they seem to go first. And so that's one of the things we got to talk about, and probably give you a little call to action for that. Coming up after the first break, though, is really the meat of the program today. We're going to be talking to a Medal of Honor recipient, Clint Robichaud, who received his Medal of Honor in 2013 for the Battle of Firebase Keating. And his book is entitled Red Platoon, and it was a great read, and I'm so excited to talk to him about this. It's just a fascinating book. And it's all about taking care of your buddy. And this is what people in the military do, men and women alike, is that, you know, everybody's got everybody else's back, and nobody's going to ever leave anybody on the field. And this is really what the Red Platoon is all about, never leaving anybody on the field, in addition to the horrific battle that took place there in 2009. So it's going to be interesting. So I encourage you to stick around for that. If you want to get in on the conversation here, you can give us a call at 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. I think you're going to really like it, the program today. I've got a couple of shout-outs here that I want to give. Number one is that, you know, we don't normally do this, or a lot of people don't do this, it seems, but this is to the VA. What? We're going to give a shout-out to the VA? Yeah, we are. The Ann Arbor VA had a commemoration event this last Friday, and it was May 6th, and it was just really, really well done. And they had it in the auditorium, and they had, you know, they had a band and patriotic music and parades and balloons, and they were giving all the Vietnam veterans there all these little commemorative pins, and they had all the different branches of the service, and it was really well done. And so I just wanted to congratulate the Ann Arbor VA especially for putting on this little commemorative program for their veterans. And I'm assuming in talking with them over there that there are going to be events like this at many of the other VAs around the country. So check out your newspapers every once in a while and see what's happening. And I think you'll like to go to this. It was really kind of interesting to see all these guys and women there. There were a number of nurses, of course, that were at the activity at the Ann Arbor VA. And, you know, to all my friends out there, it was really kind of frightening. Like, when I was looking around the room, we all look alike. And you know, the white hair, the white beards, kind of like a little mini Santa Claus celebration. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I guess since we are now, so many of us are the senior members of military establishment, it makes me a little bit nervous. But they did honor Charlie Kettles. He was a guest speaker there, and for those of you in the local area especially, you know that Charlie Kettles, Lieutenant Colonel, aviation helicopter pilot, has been approved to receive his Medal of Honor. We just don't have a date yet when he will get it. So this whole Medal of Honor is kind of a big deal today and next week. Next week we're scheduled to have another Medal of Honor recipient on, so it's been very cool. So that's it, the Ann Arbor VA. Go to it. And the other thing that's coming up is an event that we've been very tied in with, and this is the Silver Star event, a benefit for Veterans Matter, and you've all heard about us talking about Veterans Matter. And what Veterans Matter does is the VA provides funding for apartments and housing for homeless veterans, but they don't provide the deposit, which is kind of unusual when you think about it. And so Veterans Matter has kind of come up with this idea that they're going to raise the money and they're going to provide the funding for the deposit so we can get these men and women off the streets and into, you know, livable housing. And there's a fundraiser coming up here in Ann Arbor next Saturday, May 14th, 2016. It's going to be at Father Gabriel Richard High School. It begins at, where's the time? They didn't give me the time. I think it runs from 6 to 9. Yeah, there it is. Runs from 6 to 9, Saturday, May 14th, and the tickets are $25, and they've got a great silent auction. I've been hearing about some of the really great gifts, tickets, of course, and so on and so forth. Food and spirits, wine and more. And for more information, for tickets, or to donate to the organization, go to silverstarevent.org. That's silverstarevent.org, or you can find them on Facebook at Silver Star Event. This is sponsored by Ventures Matter and Jordan Reese's, which is a respiratory supply company. And these guys are, Jordan Reese's is very, very involved in Veterans Affairs. So we encourage everybody to go out and support. This is their first attempt at raising money. And I think that they're doing really well. And all of this money, 99.9% of this money, is going to go to Veterans Matter so that they can provide those deposits for men. Veterans Matter has already got 1,000 people into apartments. So I encourage you to do that. All right. Right now. So moving right along as they see her on Veterans Radio. Joining me on the program right now is the Executive Director of the Disabled American Veterans, and their mission, of course, is to fulfill our promises to the men and women who have served. And joining me on a line from the Washington, D.C. area is Gary Augustine. Gary, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. It was an honor. You know, the more and more I look back on it, the better and better I feel about it. I
can agree with that, and I'm one of your white-haired, white-bearded colleagues.
Isn't that scary? I don't know. You know what happened? The problem is that I'm 20 years old in my mind, you know, and I got this 70-year-old body that isn't necessary. It just doesn't mix sometimes.
Yeah, I can relate.
I think a lot of us can relate to that. So tell me what the DAV is up to, and I encourage people out there for people who don't know what the DAV is. Tell us a little bit about what your organization does.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the DAV. It's one of my favorite subjects. I've been employed with the DAV for 28 years.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Started as a national service officer. We have 270 national service officers around the country. We provide free claims representation to any era of veteran, free of charge. And we are in all the VA regional offices around the country. So if you need help with your claim, you can drop into a DAV office, and one of our national service officers will take care of you. We also have many other programs, including programs to help veterans get employed. We give veterans rides to the VA hospital to meet their appointments and then wait for them and take them back home at night if they have no other way of getting there, through our voluntary service program. We provide disaster relief around the country to all veterans that are affected by natural disasters around the country. That's just a few of the many benefits and services that the DAV provides to all veterans of all eras. We're in our 95th year of existence.
Wow, that's terrific. And Gary, the reason that I asked you to come on the program today was to talk about some of these legislative issues that are being brought up in Congress right now, and I know that the DAV, along with the other service organizations, are very active in protecting the benefits that we have and hopefully expanding some of them. Can you tell a little bit about what the DAV is up to?
Absolutely. And as you probably are aware, the VA has had some issues over the last few years with access.
Yes.
And because of that, there was a law passed a few years ago, that offered the CHOICE program for veterans. And I just want to talk a little bit about CHOICE because I think there's a great misperception out there about what that means for veterans. They decided to, in order to help the VA, try to improve access for veterans to get their care, especially in the hospitals that are overburdened and may not have the ability to take care of the demand that veterans want to come to the VA, offered them something called CHOICE. And they sent 9 million cards out to the veterans that are enrolled in the VA healthcare system. And the cards are supposed to be something veterans can use if they live more than 40 miles from a VA facility that can take care of their health condition, or if they have to wait more than 30 days. And right now, Senator McCain has introduced a new bill to expand choice.
Oh, okay.
Now, the problem as we see it is the choice program was implemented very quickly, and it, much of the responsibility for implementing the program was given to third-party providers, two health insurance companies called Health Net and TriWest. And their job was to try to coordinate these people that need to go outside of the VA. And they've tried to do a very good job. They were given a tough order. But some of the problems that we've seen with choice is that as veterans try to use it and to go outside of the VA, many times they find that the providers that they are referred to aren't real clear on the reimbursement policy, may not be clear on how to treat veterans' issues. And the result is many veterans get billed for services they're not supposed to be billed for because the private provider is not patient enough to wait for reimbursement.
Right.
Then comes a little late from the VA sometimes because they're not quite coordinated well enough. So because of that, we have instituted a program or a campaign called Setting the Record Straight. And if people go to our website, www.dav.org, and go to Setting the Record Straight, you'll see five videos that we try to use to educate veterans about some of the common things that are talked about out there with choice that may be bad for veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those terms are things like let the money follow the veteran, just give them a voucher, let them go into the private community anytime they want. Some of the problems with that are the same things we're seeing with the current choice program, and that is that it's not well coordinated. Veterans end up getting fragmented care. They may not they may go to places that are treated them, but then bill them, and when they don't pay because they're not supposed to pay, they're not they should be authorized to go to those places. Then they get bill collectors coming after them. So there's a lot of problems with these simple, what seems to be simple kinds of terms and ideas. And so we're trying to oversee the current legislation that's being considered so that it can be much more coordinated through oversight by the VA and make sure that veterans don't get harmed by going outside when it's necessary.
Right. I think that that's always seems to be a problem whenever you get a corporation involved that's more profit-driven than it, in many cases, and service-driven. And I'm not... I realize I'm throwing stones, but
no, you're right.
But it's true, and especially when they don't understand the audience or the patients that they're going to be dealing with. I mean, veterans can be a little bit more, you know, different, and you know, especially when they're used to certain types of care. And I know that one of your concerns was, you know, the rumors have been popping up about privatizing the entire VA system,
right?
And for those who use the VA system, you're going to go, no, wait a minute. They, you know, what do I got to do? I'm going to go to my primary care physician and talk about how I got, you know, whatever happened to me, where and when and how. And I think that presents a problem.
It does. And what we have found is that, and by the way, we're not against using private health care providers when the VA can't take care of the of veterans because of increased demand and not being able to provide the services in a timely manner. But it has to be coordinated. It has to be set up into a network of providers that understand what the reimbursement policies are and what veterans require as far as their treatment. You know, many veterans have conditions that the private sector doesn't see that often. And they may not be familiar with the questions they need to ask veterans so that they can make sure that they treat the whole veteran and not just a condition.
Right. And I think that's one of the directions that we have seen the VA going is to have that constant contact person you know, to help the veteran work their way through the system, and you know, to get the better care.
Exactly. And you mentioned privatization, and make no mistake, there is a movement out there that of people that would like to see the VA become just a payer and not a provider of services. Mm-hmm. And we are dead set against that, as are many of our VSO colleagues. We have made it very clear that we want to fix the problems in the VA, because we still think that VA health care is the best health care for the veterans who use it on a regular basis.
Well, I agree with that. In fact, our guest in the next segment, in part of one of the lines in his book, was something to the effect of, you know, that we know how to take care of our own, and this is what we should be doing. And,
exactly.
And it's, you know, this is a promise that you made, and because there are such a smaller number of actual active duty military today, that the civilian part of the world that doesn't really understand what their needs are.
And I think
that's something that is really important. Gary, I'd love to have you back on the program to talk more about this, but I do want to get into my next guest. But I encourage people to go to DAV.org. They've got great information there. I belong. And Gary, thank you very much. You are a service-connected disabled veteran. I didn't get into your biographical thing, but thank you for your service before your service. How's that?
All right, Dale. Thank you. And, you know, I'd be glad to come back anytime. And again, any service, anybody that needs help with their claim, can go to www.dav.org and put in your zip code, and it'll tell you the closest office to you. And all of our services are free of charge.
Absolutely. And for all of you veterans that are listening, you don't know what benefits you're entitled to sometimes. And there are some interesting ones out there.
So, absolutely. Not just federal benefits, but
right.
State benefits also.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much, Gary. We've been talking to Gary Augustine from the Disabled American Veterans. I encourage you to go to the website, dav.org. We're going to take a quick break, move some stuff around, and we'll be back with our guest, the second half of the program, Clint Romache, a Medal of Honor recipient. I'm really excited to talk to Clint. We'll be right back after this. And we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be joined by our guest in just a moment. And let me give you a little background on him. His name is Clinton Robiche, and Clint has written a book entitled Red Platoon. I encourage all of you to get out and read this book. It's a fascinating read. But anyway, Clint enlisted in the Army in 1999. He deployed twice to Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and once to Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. At the time of the attack mentioned in the text here, we will talk about that, on Combat Outpost Keating on October 3rd, 2009, Staff Sergeant Robiche was assigned as a section leader of Bravo Troop 3rd of the 61st Cavalry, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 4th Infantry Division. He's a recipient of numerous awards and decorations, of course, including the Medal of Honor. When he was separated from the service, he now lives with his family in North Dakota. Clint, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the program. I know that you have been extremely busy in promoting your new book, and I encourage, as I mentioned before, I encourage everybody to go out and get this. It's a true story of American valor, and it's not just a war story, and that's what I really enjoyed about it. Tell me, I guess we can just start at the beginning. So why did you enlist in 1999? What caused you to do that?
You know, I grew up in a family of military service. From my grandfather, World War II. My dad did tours in Vietnam. Both my brothers had served in the military, various uncles I had. So, you know, I was always kind of surrounded by service back to the country. But it wasn't like it was a prerequisite to be part of the Romiche family, to kind of get your family card stamped to serve.
Right.
You know, it was really my dad that, you know, just taught me those lessons. You don't have to put the uniform on to serve, but you got to get back to this country. Mm-hmm. And as far back as I could remember, I wanted to be in the Army. Didn't really know why. I think a lot of the guys I ended up serving with over my career, you know, we all wanted to join for one reason or another, just a desire to do something. But, you know, it was under the advice of my dad when I actually tried to sign up at 17, and he wouldn't let me. He wouldn't sign for me because he taught me some very valuable lessons in life. You know, if you put on the uniform of this military, maybe not today and maybe not in 20 years, but you'll have to go and do and see things that no man should ever have to do and see. So you'll have to make that choice when you're 18. And you know, the day after I turned 18, that's what I did. Signed up, put on the uniform, and like I said, I joined just because I wanted to join. But I really ended up serving because of the great men I got to meet and be around and be part of something more than just myself, and try to give back to what was, you know, given before me, so we could live in this great country, you know, just a free and proud people.
I can't say it any better than that, but I got a half hour to keep going. you went to Iraq twice. This is one of the things that we're always talking about on the program, is you men and the men and women today are deploying so often. It's just, to us, it seems a little bit outrageous, but I know that you look at it, this is your job, this is your profession, this is what you do. What did you do while you were in Iraq?
The initial deployment I did back in that 2004 to 2005 time frame, you know, it was very much still kinetic. At the time, I was still actually on the M1A1 tanks. Our main mission was route security on a main supply route called the MSR Michigan, to help keep that open and flowing, and help try to combat the IED threats that were going on in the area, try to disrupt them, and go kinetic and you know, try to eliminate these guys before they could even put bombs on the side of the roads. The second Iraq deployment came up in 2006 to 2008 during the surge. No, and that was more the coin fight, the counterinsurgency fight. Mm-hmm. Try to incorporate the locals and build their government and train their forces, and stay, you know, right there in small little pockets, not on the big fobs, but actually out in the local environment, with the Iraqi people to gain kind of their trust and help, you know, put a little more stability in the country, but more importantly, show them that, hey, we're right here with you, living right beside you. You know, but it's going to take your ownership to step up to the plate. We're only going to be here so long, so you've got to take it, embrace it, and own it for yourself.
That's, and I think that our audience really is unaware of all of the community building tasks that you performed while you were in Iraq. And I know that they've done that same thing, or they've attempted the same thing in Afghanistan. So not only were you involved in trying to protect yourselves and keep these routes open for supplies and so forth, but you were down on the local level trying to build schools and you know, teach, I guess, the Iraqis on how to live.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and I think we kind of get lost. We kind of got this short-term memory thing going on here.
Yeah.
A U.S. population. America is a great country in rebuilding. Look what we did in Germany. Look what we've done in Japan. Look what we've done in South Korea. But it doesn't happen overnight, and it comes from that direct involvement with the locals to get them to take ownership. But it takes a long time, and you got to stick with it until you come to, I mean, not even end. We still have bases in Europe. We still have bases in South Korea. It's a long-term investment that if you want true stability and real support for the country you're in, you got to go there for the long haul.
Yeah, I don't think people understand that you know, you just can't go in and fix everything and then leave. It doesn't quite work that way. All right, we've got about a minute before we have to take a break. So what were your feelings about going back again to another war zone to go to Afghanistan?
You know, in a way it was, you know, I'm not going to lie, it was a bit exciting. I'd done already two tours to Iraq. You know, you heard of the guys going over to Afghanistan and the challenges they faced. So as a professional soldier, to be able to go from the flatland deserts of, for the most part, and pretty wide open or congested city centers to, you know, the rugged mountain terrain, to see how physically fit are we? Can we hike up and down these mountains? You know, the Taliban fighters, you'd hear stories of them. You know, they were more willing to go toe-to-toe with you, where a lot of the insurgent fights we found in Iraq were these very quick hit-and-run type deals. So as a professional soldier, it was very exciting to kind of see both ends of the spectrum.
Can you describe the terrain in Afghanistan, especially in the eastern, northeastern area where you were?
You know, honestly, it was some of the most beautiful countryside I've ever seen. It reminded me of the Continental Divide and the mountains of the Rockies in Colorado, the rivers that flow through there. You know, the first thing I thought is these guys need to get into the tourism business because they'd make a killing.
Yeah, they should.
With whitewater rafting and the beautiful mountains and skiing.
Okay, I got to take a quick break, Clint. Hang on. We'll be back after the news. We're talking with Clint Romache. We'll be right back after this. And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Clint Romache, the author of a book, Red Platoon, The True Story of American Valor. Clint is the recipient of the Medal of Honor. And we're just talking a little bit about Afghanistan, where he was deployed in 2009. When you got to the, you guys call it COP, is it? COP Keating in Afghanistan, what did you think of that fine location?
You know, we were kind of fortunate enough in our platoon. Sergeant Kirk had just been with 173rd in that area of Afghanistan, just on his prior deployment. You know, so we got the intel dumps before even going overseas of where we'd be kind of getting located at. But, you know, that real firsthand account of Sergeant Kirk coming in mm-hmm. and saying, hey, look, boys, this is some pretty bad area. These guys are, you know, committed fighters. The terrain is horrendous. So we need to make sure we're physically fit. We understand our weapon systems, how to shoot angle fire, because a lot of it we're going to be fighting uphill. And, you know, at the time, you know, you're trying to absorb it in, incorporate that into the training. But it wasn't until the first night, because the only way to access COP Keating or Combat Outpost Keating was by helicopter, and only at night would the pilots fly in because it was just way too dangerous for them to fly during the daytime in a big mm-hmm. Chinook. They're just too easy a target. And as I stepped off the back ramp the first night coming there, and I remember kind of just spinning around trying to get my orientation and bearing, looking through my night vision goggles, you know, and when you wear a set of night vision goggles, you can always kind of pick up where the land, the terrain, and the horizon, the sky is. No matter how dark it is, you always kind of have a reflection of the sun on the opposite side of the world. You can always kind of pick that up. And I just remember looking around thinking, oh, these night vision goggles must be broke because all I'm seeing is black. And then bright and early the next morning, woke up. You know, we got outside, you know, get a little more oriented, see things in the daytime. I just remember looking around and I'm like, oh, those weren't broke at all. I just wasn't looking high enough, apparently. So it all kind of hits you at once and you're like, dang you, Kirk, you were right. But it, you know, the initial reaction is who the heck would put an outpost here? This is, I mean, the total opposite of the definition of a defensible position. Yet, you know, it's one of those things that soldiers, you know, we live in a volunteer service right now where everyone that serves, you know, willingly and voluntarily went and done it. And that's what happens when these young men and women raise that right hand and say, I'm going to go and do, you don't get the choice. That's the freedoms you give up. That when your military says, hey, here's where we need you, you got to go. That's the sacrifice they give. And we looked at it as, yeah, this might have been less than ideal, but, you know, game on. This is what we got, and we're going to make the best of it. And there's nothing that they're going to ever do to us that's going to make us, you know, not understand that we love each other so much, you can give us the worst conditions ever, and we're going to make the best possible situation out of it because right. we're going to overcome, and it's that attitude that you see time and time again through military service.
Absolutely, and actually you found inside one of the buildings there, somebody had already carved into the ceiling there. It said something, I thought, it doesn't get better.
Doesn't get any better. We embrace that phrase, and like I said, it couldn't get better. We made every day the best day possible, and looking back, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I don't care if Donald Trump gave me a blank check right now and today I'll take that experience back. No, not at all. But those great men and the character I got to serve with, you could have made those mountains another 1,000 feet taller. And just to be there with those guys, that wouldn't have mattered.
I think that's what I found so fascinating about your book. I'm talking with Clinton Robiche, who's author of Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. And the book is, it's not a memoir. It's more of, it's more of to honor those that you served with. It's a way that I read it anyway, and especially the ones that you lost.
You know, it's one of those things, like I said, my dad never really talked about Vietnam at all. You know, it was kind of hard for him to open up with the stuff he had seen. And, you know, everyone kind of deals with it different. But as far as writing the book and a lot of our veterans out there, you know, it's hard to open up and talk to people that haven't been there or done that. But it's also kind of our duty to make sure, especially when we live in a day where less than 1% serves this country. You know, if we don't share our stories and let those 99.5 that haven't served have no clue about it. If we don't convey that service and sacrifice, it's going to be forgotten. It's going to be neglected. And I do have to say, Dale, I appreciate your service and your sacrifice. You know, serving in the time of Vietnam, you guys didn't get treated very well at all coming back, but it was because of your generation that every time I came home and my generation came home, we came home to cheering and welcoming crowds. And we can't thank you guys enough for that.
Well, thank you very much. It's, you know, it's kind of our motto, never again. Is that going to ever happen to an American veteran? And it's amazing, though, in your story, Clint, when you were mentioning, and I guess I want to try and set the scenario, and I don't want to give the whole book away because it's such a fascinating read to me. But before you were attacked, just like everybody in the military does, when there's a little downtime, you figure out what would you do if you were the other guys? If you were on the other team and you wanted to take this base, what would you do it? And you guys pretty much nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, we sat there many a night. We sat there, and me and Gallegos and Kirk and Bunderman and Raz and Larson would kind of just game plan. And that's what kind of gave us the advantage. They look, what are we going to do to counter? They've got easy access. You know, they can observe us from every different direction. You know, what can we do to improve? Where do we need to stash ammo in case we get isolated? What do we need to relocate battle positions to every couple of days? How do we need to change our guard shifts and our reaction drills when we get attacked? You know, and you kind of got to be in that mindset that, well, what would I do if I had the opportunity to come up against this? And that, I think, you know, is just a test of how the military trains our great men and women. And you know, you've got to be flexible and maneuverable and understanding that, yeah, these were very, very well trained and very dedicated enemy that we were faced with that day.
I think it's kind of fascinating when you think about what the military teaches you about going through, you know, your kind of your checklist. You go from plan A to B to C to D, and you never stop, you know, coming up with alternatives to what you can do. And this is something that you pointed out later on in your book about employers. They don't understand that veterans just keep, you know, going through their card list of ideas and plans and how they're going to make whatever that you want them to do to be a success.
Yeah, and that's why I say we need to share these stories. And like I said, bring this awareness because, yeah, a lot of civilian employers that don't understand veterans or the military, hey, when you hire one of these guys, it doesn't matter what their MOS was. You know, you're going to get a guy or a gal that, one, can wake up and show up to work on time in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Two, understands rules and regulations. Three, has initiative for days. Four, will accept the challenge way above their understanding, but will do everything in their power to get a handle on it and learn it as quick as possible with minimal guidance. And just understands how to have working relationships with all sorts of different personality types because you get that such exposure being in the military.
I was going to say, where are you ever going to meet people like you met in real life?
Nowhere.
I mean, you talk about diversity. You know, I mean, you meet people from all over the world, and it's such an enlightening experience to run into these men and women, and you find out what everybody else is thinking. I got to get back to your story, or I'll run out of time here. All right, so we've got you guys have been talking about how you would defend the base. How big was Cop Keating anyway?
Overall size, I mean, the very far east west side was maybe a little over 200 meters. The farthest north and south sides were at the widest, probably 150. I mean, it really was not a very large outpost at all. It was, you know, it was cozy, I guess is what we'd call it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, at times you think, well, this is very big. But during that day, I mean, what seemed to be just only a couple of feet away seemed like miles at times just because mm-hmm. the enemy's advantage that they had on you looking down. Yet, you know, you'd learn from previous battle drills, you know, where can I duck and
right.
where can I kind of scoot up next mm-hmm. to, you know, that experience paid off that day.
You mentioned when you guys were shooting the breeze about what you would do, that you would attack right around 6 o'clock in the morning. So what happened on that morning when you were attacked?
You know, bright and early, just before 6. I was still racked out in my bunk. I had just gotten off Sergeant of the Guard duty the night prior. Our platoon was tasked with the perimeter defense. So I was still, you know, fast asleep when the first rounds came in. And it really was not uncommon at all to have some gunfire come in around that time in the morning. But that morning, you know, when you heard it come in and woke up, threw my kid on, was powering my radio up. I mean, just the amount that was coming in. Machine gun fire, recoilless rifle fire, rocket-propelled grenade, mortar fire. And you could hear there was more coming in than going out. And normally, you know, our guys, we had trained, you got to gain that fire superiority. These men went on, you know, the offensive right away with trying to get the guns in the fight and going into what we call a cyclic rate of fire. As fast as they could try and shoot back, they were trying, but just wasn't happening that morning. Also knowing, as we kind of game planned it, that bright and early in the morning, typically there wasn't, you know, immediate air coverage in the area. So you knew it was going to take a little time for it to get there. And the enemy had planned for that. You've seen it in attacks before where the Taliban fighters really liked it. If they could get in close to you or as close as possible, they knew Americans were pretty shy about bringing in airstrikes and close air support, you know, right on top of themselves. And it, you know, that morning kicked off in just a matter of minutes. What was going from bad to worse was getting just worse and worse and worse by almost a minutely basis.
It sounds that the way. I'm looking at a picture here of Cop Keating, and it's like you're down in this valley almost, and you're surrounded by these humongous mountains, and you know the bad guys are all over you, and they had driven everybody out of a village across the little river from you, and you were just taking fire from 360 degrees, weren't you?
Yeah, it came in from the east, it came in from the west, the north, the south. I mean, they had positions in. And because we set so far, I mean, we were at the very, very bottom of that valley. And I mean, when we would go on patrols and you would just climb elevation, you know, 400 feet above it, the amount of dead space is what you call it, space you just can't observe from your position, that was available to the enemy to infill in on us without being observed at all, would just blew your mind. And, you know, the night before, that's what they were able to do, get in positions. And because of how extreme it was, you had to use what we call plunging fire, where you're trying to basically lob rounds on top of them, because all they have to do is just take a few steps back, and you don't have a direct line of sight or a direct shot on them. So for them to get as close as they did that morning was relatively easy, just because we didn't have good coverage on early warning.
Well, and one of the lines in the book that you mentioned was some older guy says they're in the wire, which. For those, you know, for Vietnam veterans, we all know they're in the wire, and kind of a little levity there. But the point is that they were getting closer and closer, and you and your colleagues were, some of them were isolated.
You know, it got to the point that day that within almost the first hour they'd breached our perimeter. We had enemy inside, and when that call came across, I mean, you just shook your head and it's like, how is this happening? You know, this is something just, you always kind of think, well, it might be some other unit you read in Stars and Stripes that this will happen to you. But when you heard it come across the net, it kind of had to take a double take, you know, what was going on. Oh, wow. But it was one of those moments, just like, you know, a lot of challenges you face in your life, you stumble a little bit, but if you don't shake it off and refocus very quickly, you're going to fall pretty soon.
Well, and a number of your comrades were wounded, and some unfortunately were killed almost right away. And I tried to bring this up a little bit at the beginning of the program. Is you and the rest of them, you wanted to make sure that you had everybody. Why was it so important to get the bodies of the people that were killed?
You know, it was one of those things that I'd learned kind of early on in my military career, and I'd try to convey it to some of the younger soldiers. You know, that unfortunately, you go to combat and you go over there with everybody, and then the nature of the beast, you know, we're not over there selling Girl Scout cookies, giving away free popsicles. Everybody's going over, but not everybody's coming home alive. But everyone's going to come home. You know, today being Mother's Day of all days, the worst feeling in the world is to come home and have a mother not have their son or daughter anymore. And what's even worse than that is not having their body.
right.
to lay to rest, to do the last rites, to give at least a little closure. And I don't care, you know, that day, I really wasn't scared what was ever going to happen to me. That thought didn't even cross my mind. What scared that every living bejesus out of me was the fact that there was no way they were going to take any of these boys off this place. They were not going to be propaganda. And I was more scared for not getting to them than I was for maybe not even making it home.
No, I that was very evident in the book when you were talking about it. And I can't relate entirely because I've never been a ground attack, but you know, you just don't think about getting hurt yourself. Your goal is to just go and get the wounded, the people that are dead, get the bodies, whatever it is, and get them out. Because as you pointed out, you didn't want the Taliban to be using these American GIs as propaganda pieces, which is what they usually utilize in social media out there. See, we got one, and then they do something terrible to that person who you, as you admitted, you love in a way, and that these people are very important to you.
Absolutely. In fact, coming back to those values of duty and honor and trust and loyalty,
mm-hmm.
that, I knew that day that if the roles were reversed, if I was stuck up in that Humvee, I knew San Gallegos was going to do everything in his power to come get me, no matter what. That was the least we could do for him.
Absolutely. I got your back thing, and many people don't understand how serious that people in the military take that. You know, the person on your right and your left is most important to you. This battle that you somehow survived, you were wounded almost right away, weren't you? You just didn't know it.
It came to a point where myself and Gregory had tried to put a machine gun position, sneak one in to help try to get some guys that were stuck at the Humvee some covering fire, hopefully shoot enough bullets to keep the enemy's head down so those guys could come back into the relative safety of what we ended up calling the Alamo position.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, as I tried to teach my guys, when you're in the heat of things, that's one of the biggest things is that situational awareness and keeping your head on a swivel. And I made the mistake. I got the blinders on, and I got a little too focused, and a group of fighters outflanked us to the right. Didn't see them come through the wire, the front gate area, and they fired an RPG into us. And it hit, and it was one of those first things, it rings your bell and kind of stumbled. And I remember grabbing Gregory and making sure he was okay, and called up Gallegos, said, just can't hold the position, finish the last of the ammunition we had. And, you're running on adrenaline, and you understand, well, shoot, if I can still walk, talk, and move and shoot, well, I still must be good enough. And it wasn't until Sergeant Rasmussen came over to kind of identify that, hey, man, you've gotten hit, which is kind of a jerk move, because at first, I didn't even feel it until you said something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you refocus and understand, well, this is, we can power through it. We can take one more step. And as long as we're still moving, as long as we're still going forward, we're still going to be successful. And keeping that mindset was absolutely critical.
My adrenaline is already rushing through me here as I'm listening to this, because I'm thinking about what do I want to ask you, because we only have about 5 minutes left. One of the things that I found most fascinating from a tactical standpoint was how you were able to bring in the airstrikes. I mean, you had aircraft stacked up from 1,000 feet to 30,000 feet. And that's a great part of the story.
That's amazing. The level of support, we've got a lot of rivalry going on between the Army, the Marines, the Air Force, the Navy. We always razz each other. But when push comes to shove, it doesn't matter what branch of service or what uniform of service you're wearing, they've all got your back. And it, truly, because of Lieutenant Bunderman, his amazing leadership skills that day, if it wasn't for him on that radio coordinating all that, the Air Force guys that were coming in and doing those bomb drops and being such professionals at their job, to be able to put that trust in them. And that's what I think builds on to why we have the greatest military
mm-hmm.
that history has ever seen. It's that level of trust, knowing you're always going to have someone coming to get you. You're always going to have someone at your back. And we as veterans need to continue to remember that even after service, after we take off that uniform, that, warriors helping warriors is probably the best thing that we've got going for us. And we're in a fraternity like no other. You couldn't in a million years try to get people to be so tight, and just be in such an amazing fraternity, unless you've served.
No, and it's important, as you mentioned, in your writing the book, and this is something that I've always had, is that it's not that we don't like other authors, but sometimes they mess up the facts, and they can't really get the emotional attachment that we have with our comrades in the service, and sometimes they miss out on it. It's up to us to tell our stories, and that's why we do this program, and it's obviously why you wrote your book, because also you lost 8 very, very close friends. And you mentioned in there, and I've heard this from other Medal of Honor recipients, that you know, you're not the hero. They are the true heroes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we use the word hero pretty liberally in today's society. We call people that throw footballs heroes. We call people that have sex changes heroes. No, true heroes don't come home. That's what a hero is.
That's true.
And the reason that the book, I think, is so well done, it's because it wasn't Quint Romesha that day. It was a whole group of guys, and going around the country and getting my buddies to open up, doing face-to-face interviews with them, sitting down for 3 or 4 days to recapture stories and listen to each other. And as veterans talk to veterans, it's more about the words that aren't getting spoken than that are. And that's why it's hard for us to kind of talk to people that don't truly understand, because they, you know, they weren't there, and we kind of hold that stuff close. But you know, it's still worthwhile that every time a veteran opens up and starts to speak, it's a good time to just shut up and listen, just to listen to them. And as part of doing Red Platoon, yeah, that face-to-face interviews, allowing the men that came home, their ability to voice and give their perspective, to tell just a more clear 360 kind of view of the battle that day. And to also give testament for those 8 great men that didn't make it home. They don't get to share their story anymore. And if we don't share it, it's pretty selfish of us to sit there and hide it to ourselves, because they won't ever get a chance to do it again.
Yeah, you just don't want them to go away.
You know, it's one of the biggest tragedies is, you know, the loss of a service member. But what's even more tragic is to forget about them. And as long as we never do that, they're never truly gone.
No, they are not. And I strongly encourage, thank you, Clint, so very much for being on Veterans Radio today. And I strongly encourage people to go out and read this book, Red Platoon. It's not just about one man. It's about service people and their love and their respect and their need to help people in general. And I want to thank you for writing that book. I think it's a great read, and I'm going to be recommending that to everybody I can get it to.
Well, I appreciate it so much for allowing me to come on the radio today and share some of my thoughts. And I just, once again, thank you so much for your service and all those great men and women out there that are still wearing the uniform. Once again, it is Mother's Day, so boys, make sure you call your moms.
That's right. Better.
Without those lovely ladies, we wouldn't be the great men we are, men and women we are today.
That's true. And they were the ones that were at home praying that you came home safely.
It's a family business. Just because one person puts a uniform on and goes overseas, hey, it's those moms, wives, grandmothers, aunts that served just as much as I ever did.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Clinton Robichet, author of Red Platoon, great book. Make sure you go out and read that. Thank you, Clint. I hope to be talking to you again sometime soon.
Oh, most definitely. It was a true pleasure today.
Thank you. All right. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to play a song for you that I heard when I was at the Ann Arbor VA the other day. And this is a song written by a woman named Kelly Trudell. And Kelly is kind of this veterans troubadour that's out there singing songs for the veterans of the world. And her song, and I think it's appropriate, we won't get to play the whole thing, but it's called Sound of Hope. And it's dedicated to medevac pilots. And when you read Clint's book, you're going to see that they were doing everything in the world to get these medevacs in there. So I'm going to be quiet now. Stay tuned next week. We'll be back on Veterans Radio. Until then, Kelly Trudell, Sound of Hope.